This is recorded on the morning of July the 30th, 1970, in the offices of Dean Frederick N. Andrews, Vice President for Research and Dean of the Graduate School, Vice President and General Manager of the Purdue Research Foundation, Professor of Animal Sciences, and R.B. Eccles of the Department of History. This recording is made for the Purdue University Archives. Dean Andrews, suppose you start out with the usual question. Where were you born? Take us up through your elementary education until the time you decided to go to college.
Well, I was born in Boston, Massachusetts. Our home was in Weymouth, Massachusetts, which is down toward Cape Cod and about 20 miles south of Boston. My elementary education was in the grammar schools at Weymouth, Massachusetts, with the exception because my father was a civil engineer and did a great deal of work outside of the United States, we spent 1 year in Honduras in Central America. During that time, my sister and I were taught by our parents and fortunately were a little ahead of the class when we returned a year later. On another occasion, we spent a year in Florida where my father was involved in building a radio telegraph station and were in the junior high school of the Miami school system. The remainder of the time was spent in Weymouth, Massachusetts.
Graduate from Weymouth High School?
Yes, I was a graduate of Weymouth High in the class of 1931.
All right. Now, where did you go to college?
I was an undergraduate at the University of Massachusetts. At the time I entered, the fall of 1931, it was the Massachusetts State College, and the change of name came several years after my graduation.
How did you decide to get to take your major?
Well, at the time I entered the university, I felt that I was interested in some aspect of animal production as relating to agriculture. And this was the reason for my choice of the University of Massachusetts. During the time that I was enrolled as a student, I became interested in the university as a profession, both in teaching and research. And at the beginning of my junior year, I had already made a decision that I would take graduate work, probably in either animal physiology or animal nutrition at some other university.
Do you remember any deans or professors who particularly influenced you?
I think several people, a small number, had a very great influence. The dean of the School of Agriculture was also the head of the Department of Animal Sciences and a very accomplished teacher and a distinguished geneticist. He interested me in the scientific aspects of animal sciences from the moment I entered the university. As I began my junior year, I was exposed to one of the few PhDs on the agricultural faculty at University of Massachusetts. He was a fresh PhD from the University of Missouri, had been trained in the area of reproductive and endocrine physiology, and from that moment on, I think my decision was made.
Well, now, who were these people? Who was the dean?
The dean of agriculture was Dean Victor Arthur Rice. And the professor who influenced me was Dr. Ralph W. Phillips. He later became the senior animal scientist for the United Nations. And I have kept up my relationship with him and, in fact, my present service on a commission of the Organization of American States is the result of the nomination by Dr. Phillips to be the United States representative.
Who's Carl Hartman?
Carl Hartman was a very famous research worker and teacher in reproductive physiology, was for many years at Johns Hopkins University. I met him through a family relationship. He had a good deal of influence on me, and he was such an influential person that when I asked if he would write a letter of recommendation to the University of Missouri, he wrote one on a penny postcard in pencil advising them that Fred Andrews was probably a pretty good prospect, and he had enough influence that it played a considerable part in my being accepted.
Now, this is where you became interested then, as an undergraduate, in your reproductive endocrine physiology, anatomy, biochemistry, and nutrition of animals.
That is right.
And you went to Columbia, Missouri, which is situated in the heart of Boone County. That's where they raise the famous Boone County ham, isn't it? And what year did you enter the University of Missouri?
I went to the University of Missouri during the summer of 1936.
Are you aware of, Professor, that there is an Eccles that has a building named after him on the campus of the Agnes Station?
That is right. That is right. A very famous man.
Yes.
Is he a relative of yours?
I think he is from the other branch. We met when I taught at Columbia. I taught at Columbia for 2 years at Stevens College, which was at that time an educational institution of sorts. However, then you went out to live in Columbia. Did you live out in that part of town close to the Ag School?
I lived very close to the Ag School. Mm-hmm. Of course, it was not so far from Stevens College either.
No. It said someplace was. I take it you picnicked on the banks of the Hickson.
I enjoyed, as a graduate student, Columbia very much.
Well, what did you study there?
My studies at the University of Missouri were primarily in physiology, especially reproductive physiology, endocrinology, nutrition, and biochemistry. A good portion of them were taken within the agricultural experiment station, and the remainder were taken in the School of Medicine.
As I remember, there was no official School of Medicine at Missouri, but there was one heck of a good agricultural experiment station.
When I was there, they had the first 2 years of medicine.
2 years.
There was a hospital in connection with the university, which was operated by the medical group. Their students at that time were forced to transfer to other medical schools, particularly in St. Louis, and the four-year medical school was developed shortly after I finished.
What about the Ag Experiment Station?
Well, some people, especially those in Boston, asked why a New Englander would go to the middle part of the United States, to the University of Missouri. The University of Missouri at that time was very well known to many people in the East because of their journalism school.
Yes.
But they had, at that time, I believe, the most outstanding agricultural experiment station in the United States, if not the world.
And so you worked in the experiment station?
Yes.
All right, then how did you make your contact with Purdue?
Well, I actually had two contacts with Purdue. The first came through Dean Freeman, who was Associate Dean of the School of Agriculture and in charge of instruction. And as I was completing my work at the University of Missouri, he interviewed me and offered me a position teaching genetics in the department of, the Department of Animal Husbandry. I had not majored in genetics, although I was familiar with the area and interested in it. My principal interest was in the reproductive field, and I decided not to take the position. A year later, Dr. W.V. Lambert, who had been the chief scientist in the Bureau of Animal Industry, came to Purdue University as director of the Agricultural Experiment Station. I had been in contact with him while at the University of Missouri because, among other things, I was employed as a cooperative agent of the United States Department of Agriculture. As soon as Dr. Lambert arrived at Purdue, and I believe he came in January, he contacted me and asked if I would be interested in a new position, which he intended to create, which would be in my own particular area.
And then you came and taught what? What did you do when you first came here?
I came to Purdue in the spring of 1940. Of course, the semester was nearly finished then, and although schedules had been partially made for the coming fall semester in the fall of 1940, I taught a group of students a new course, the physiology of reproduction of domestic animals, that fall. The course grew year by year, and I was soon teaching 80 or 100 students each fall at the junior-senior level in this area of reproduction. I organized within a year two graduate level courses. One, the advanced courses in physiology of reproduction, and introduced for the first time a course in endocrine physiology here at Purdue.
You were also did something that I've heard about in an interview with Professor Fontaine. Didn't you get into environmental physiology?
I was actually employed by Dr. Lambert with the intent of doing what was then called cooperative work with all people interested in animal physiology on the campus. We now refer to such activities as interdisciplinary or multidisciplinary. But in the course of my work here at Purdue, I became associated with people in many different departments. And I recall distinctly when Professor Fontaine, Bill Fontaine as we all know him, came to my office and said that he was interested in getting into some new areas and wondered if we had anything in common. We decided that the area of environmental physiology had a great future, and we began a campaign not only to stimulate interest here on the campus, but to gain support elsewhere, particularly in fundraising, and ultimately the Herrick Laboratory for Refrigeration Research and Environmental Control was developed out of this.
I know he mentioned it, and I see that you had it in your list of questions. Did you use full-time teaching, or did you also do some time for research?
Well, I think that unlike many in the university in the early 1940s, especially prior to World War II, people in the Agricultural Experiment Station had a really unique appointments, because my original appointment was approximately 25% teaching and 75% research. This gave me unusual opportunities to do research work.
All right. In other words, but you continued to teach both undergraduates and graduates.
I continued this during until I became an administrator. I was involved with both undergraduates and graduates.
Now, I noticed that you had a chance to publish with Dr. Rice while you were here. You published a book called Breeding and Improvement of Farm Animals.
I believe if anyone asked what gave me the most satisfaction as a teacher, I think I would have to say that it was an opportunity with Dean Rice to develop a book which has been published in 6 editions, which has appeared in a Spanish edition, a Polish edition, and a Far East edition. And as I travel, especially in Latin America or elsewhere in the world, and stop in the libraries, look at the card index, or look at the shelves, our book is always there. And I believe the teaching function is extremely important, and the influence, or the opportunities to influence hundreds or even thousands of students, is a very stimulating thing.
Now, is research still your greatest interest? After all, you are vice president in charge of research.
Well, I think I would say that research is really the dessert course in a university. We have other very important things which must be done. But those who have an opportunity to contribute to the development and acquisition of new knowledge and then seeing it put to work, research is a very stimulating thing, and I believe one of the vital functions of any university, particularly a land-grant university such as our own.
All right. Now, let's just go into the, since we're talking about research, let's go in with that one a little further. What about your research efforts? You have anything you want to talk, put on tape about it?
In my early years, we began researches in several different areas. One of these was in the area of environmental physiology, because we were concerned about the effects of the climatic environment upon fertility. This had very practical aspects with regard to domestic animals, because the level of fertility does vary throughout the year. And the objective of any farmer is to produce as many calves or lambs or pigs or chickens as possible. We were concerned in determining the mechanisms which were involved and what could be done to improve fertility. But man is also influenced by these climatic effects. And the natural level of fertility of man does vary throughout the world. There are some periods, especially in the spring months of the year in North America, when fertility is much higher than it is in, for example, midsummer in July and August. And as we get into more tropical areas, the effects of high temperatures have a depressing effect upon fertility. Now, by studying the basic mechanisms which are involved, it was only natural that systems for fertility control which would inhibit fertility. This is an aspect of population control.
In other words, you got into veterinary science, biochemistry, mechanical engineering, pharmacy. Got into all of it, didn't you?
In the 20 years in which I was an active research worker and a teacher, we did develop interest and needs in all of those areas which you mentioned.
Now, there's one I didn't mention that you have down here, and it's bionucleonics.
The need of any professor, faculty member, to keep up with changing technology is one which exists constantly. Following World War II and the announcement of the Manhattan Project, the availability of radioactive materials which could be used to assist investigators in finding out exactly how drugs and vitamins and hormones worked, brought me into contact with a young assistant professor in the School of Pharmacy, Dr. John Christian. John was later to develop an entirely new department called the Department of Bionucleonics. And this department was involved with the uses of radioactive materials in biological investigations and the effects of radioactive substances upon the living organism. We had many joint graduate students together. So for me, this was again training in a new area which now became valuable to me as a research worker, but also in which it was necessary to be informed in order to move with the new science.
All right, now by that time, I note that you have published, and for the tape I want to say that I hope we have a list of them that will be put into an appendix along with your curriculum vitae of three books, 150 different journal papers, and chapters in other books. We don't need to go into them here unless you wish to mention particularly some of the books.
Our book, Breeding and Improvement of Farm Animals, of course, has become a standard and, in a sense, a classic. It's a little presumptive for an author to use that term, but it has been a very outstanding one. The other two books dealt with certain aspects of animal physiology and animal production, but have had far less use. I think I should say that no one publishes 150 journal articles all by himself. Working with the different faculty members in the different departments that we've already mentioned, I not only developed close personal relationships which were satisfying, but we jointly got ourselves involved in scientific studies of many disciplines. And of course, at the same time, a faculty who are involved in research are almost always dependent upon graduate students as a part of the team. And many graduate students, both my own and those which were joint with other faculty members in other departments, these graduate students made very important contributions.
May I ask, where are some of your graduate students gone?
My very first graduate student, Dr. Ralph Erb, was trained in physiology of reproduction, left Purdue University after receiving his degree to go to Washington State University, has returned to this campus and is the associate head of the Department of Animal Sciences. Another of my first graduate students, Dr. Wheeler, was a student of Dr. William Heestand in the Department of Biological Sciences. In 1940, the facilities and funds available in biological sciences for research were very modest. And Dr. Wheeler, Dr. Heestand, and I jointly directed a study of the influence of the climatic environment upon spermatogenesis in male chickens. Dr. Wheeler later received the Doctor of Medicine degree, practiced briefly in Berea, Kentucky, and is now in charge of certain branches of clinical medicine in Abbott Laboratories in North Chicago, Illinois. Another one of my first graduate students became head of the Department of Poultry Science at the University of Maryland. Another is one of the most distinguished investigators in factors affecting fertility in males, Dr. John Almquist at the University or Pennsylvania State University, and so on.
Well, it's nice to know that you've had those, at least you've done some good in continuing the science. Now, after all, you're a research man and a teacher. Oftentimes, these people do not become interested in administration. How in heaven's name did you become interested in administrative activities?
Well, I think that, like many other faculty members, I had no intentions whatsoever to be in academic administration, and resisted numerous opportunities which presented themselves to be considered as a department head at other universities and also to take research and administrative positions in industry. But my good friend Dean Earl Butts had other plans. He was quite interested, when the opportunity presented itself, of combining the work in all of the animal departments. We had had separate departments of poultry husbandry, animal husbandry, dairy husbandry. And Dean Butts and many of the members of the faculty felt that it would be desirable, mutually desirable, to combine these departments. And I became part of his plan. When Dr. Howard Gregory retired as head of the Department of Dairy Science, Dean Butts asked if I would head up that department for a year, which I did. Professor Claude Harper, who was nearing retirement, had an opportunity to engage in a project in Indonesia. He was interested in doing this, and he announced his retirement a year early, or requested leave a year prior to retirement. Dean Butts then decided to go ahead with the full consolidation of the three departments. Dr. J. Holmes Martin had another year or two before retirement, but Dr. Martin was so interested in assisting with this consolidation that he said he would be glad to relinquish his responsibility as department head and to work with me in consolidating the departments. And this is how it came about.
So you became head on January 1st, 1962.
That is right.
All right. Now, a year later, you became graduate dean and vice president for research. How did that come about?
Well, I must say that surprised me some, because being deeply involved in consolidating three departments and forming the largest department in the School of Agriculture, I had no expectation that I would ask to be considered to be considered for any other appointment at Purdue University. Now it happened that I had had a long interest in the graduate school and, of course, a continuing interest in research. I had been, under Dean E.C. Young, a very young member of the Graduate Council in 1946 and 1950. Dean Young conceived the idea, in conjunction with President Hufte, of having a system of rotating deans in the graduate school. The purpose of this would be to give young faculty members experience with a total university. So, having finished a term on the Graduate Council, I was appointed as assistant to the dean of the graduate school for the period from 1950 to 1954. Other members, I was the first to occupy this position, and other members were soon added. And I think it is of interest that Vice President Hawkins, who was later Dean of the School of Engineering, served as Assistant Dean of the Graduate School, that Vice President Loschi of the regional campuses was at one time an Assistant Dean of the Graduate School, as was Henry Koffler, Head of Biological Sciences, Dr. Joseph Whaling, who was both Associate Dean of the Graduate School and Director of the Division of Sponsored Programs within the Foundation, Leonard Breen, Head of our Department of Sociology, and Ralph Davis, who has an administrative position in the Division of Sponsored Programs and the Graduate School, all served as rotating deans of the graduate school before assuming their present administrative positions.
Well, the graduate school at Purdue, in a sense, is very young, isn't it? Your first graduate dean was Dukes, appointed in 1929, and then E.C. Young succeeded Dukes in 1942. Sense, this is a very young graduate school and graduate programs. What did you feel about the graduate school when you took it over? Was it sort of a nice, respectable plateau? Some places a graduate school is, of course, just that.
I think in many universities, which might be described as mature universities, the graduate school is regarded as sort of the end of the line, that not very much is going to happen. It's a position in which you have considerable prestige and perhaps some dignity.
You get to attend all the dinners for the visiting dignitaries.
It's a lot of ceremonial functions, but nobody expects that that there'll be a great deal of ferment. Now, I'm not sure that holds for some of the other so-called mature universities, but it certainly never applied to Purdue. Our graduate school, being young and finding ourselves in the period during which science and all scholarship was growing rapidly following World War II, I assumed my responsibility at a time when the graduate school was growing literally by leaps and bounds.
Can you give us some figures?
Well, if we go back to a base year of 1940, when there were only 400 graduate students, and up to the 1950s, when there were probably 2,400 graduate students, at the present time, we have, on any one semester, 5,000 graduate students in residence on the Lafayette campus, and about 2,500 taking one or more courses beyond the baccalaureate degree on the regional campus.
Making a total of about what per year?
Well, during the course of a year, we have about 11,000 individuals which take one or more graduate courses. Now, these figures might be somewhat misleading because many of the people on the regional campuses are teachers in the Indiana school system who wish to improve themselves and be candidates for master's degrees. Many of them in Indianapolis and Hammond, Calumet areas of Fort Wayne are young engineers, scientists, or in other professions in which they feel the need to take advanced study. There's 2,500 of them on the regional campuses. On the Lafayette campus, the graduate student is much more discipline-oriented. He's more like the average faculty member. He's interested in getting an advanced degree and hopefully preparing himself for some type of academic work.
All right. Now, it is hard to measure quality, of course, but how do we stand? Rank us nationally, if you can, in graduate work.
Well, I would be the first to say that a graduate school should be, that the quality of a graduate school should be measured by the numbers of students enrolled.
Yeah.
One of the criteria which most graduate deans do find valuable is the number of PhDs actually awarded. Now, if over a period of years a large number of PhD degrees are awarded, and the recipients all obtain good positions in either the academic world or industry, this is a pretty good indication that you're turning out the kind of people who can make their way. On this basis, then, we have been 13th in PhD production in all academic fields since 1953. In all sciences, we are 10th. In pharmacy, first. Agriculture, third. Engineering, fourth. Chemistry, sixth. Biology, 10th. These are pretty substantial numbers of the nation's PhD pool.
In some of this, in pharmacy, chemistry, and in certain branches of biology, it's perfectly obvious that we have a faculty of international repute. I'm thinking of Brown in chemistry, of course.
In sum, we are very, very good. You mentioned Herb Brown, who is a professor of organic chemistry, a distinguished professor on our campus, a member of the National Academy of Sciences, the winner of almost every national or international award, with the exception yet of the Nobel Prize, which he might eventually win. These are distinguished people.
And then we had, of course, a physics department with PhDs put out under the direction of Karl Lark Horowitz, who was one of the world's greatest physicists.
Lark Horowitz was a very interesting and talented man, and in an area at a time when physicists were expected mostly to be teachers, Lark Horowitz developed several areas of physics, particularly the area of solid-state physics, which was completely unknown at the time. As the result of work in solid-state physics, the transistor, the recorder which we're using today, guidance systems for satellites, none of these would be possible without this work.
In 1966, the Carter Report, a study of the American Council on Education, came out. Do you think we came out badly from that? I've heard some of my colleagues have made a lot of remarks about it, but we did not come out too badly, did we?
The Carter Report is regarded by many, particularly those in the Ivy League schools, Berkeley and California, as the standard for rating graduate schools. Now, the system which Carter used assumed that a university had a classical organization. For example, it would have a department in the humanities areas, it would have a department of the classics. Latin and Greek would probably be taught. In the sciences, there were separate departments of botany and zoology and anatomy. At Purdue University, we have none of these. Our biological sciences is more representative of the modern movement. We have all of the biological sciences interacting together, and we are internationally known in the area of molecular and biochemical biology. So for us, either from the humanity standpoint or the scientific aspect, the Carter study was not made up to allow us really to participate fully.
Also, there's another thing too. We had we have an excellent program of its kind and quantitative economics in the Krannert School, and that was just starting in '66.
And there was no provision made for such a department in the Carter Report.
And also, the men who answered it were asked to rate schools, and I remember, for example, that my friends in the chemistry department fumed because the people who answered the questions were oftentimes graduates themselves of departments, say, at Illinois, that were not tops at the present time, but they rated their old school out of admiration and love.
There were a lot of opportunities to influence the Carter Report, actually, with the exception of the humanities here at Purdue. And we were not even rated at all in the humanities because our PhD programs at that time were so new that no questions were asked about work in this area. But we actually came out quite well in most areas.
Agriculture came out very well.
Agriculture came out very well. Engineering came out well. The sciences came out
well. I remember the ME and the EE programs were the ones rated most highly, were they not?
Yes.
ME, EE, and CHEMI.
Yes. Civil engineering, actually, in this report, did not rate as high as it should have. We have one of the most outstanding departments of civil engineering in the entire world.
I know that. Well, now that you've been here since 63, naturally, the next question is, of course, what changes have come about in the graduate schools in 63 that you'd like to talk about?
Well, for one thing, we have several new PhD programs. We have a PhD program in English, a new PhD program in political science, one in the Department of Philosophy, and a program, PhD program, in the Department of History. I think this indicates a definite growth of the university in the area of the humanities.
And yet, let's just for a second stop there. When I talk to people in these interviews and elsewhere, they very much resent this. They feel, men in engineering particularly, feel that too much money is being devoted to the humanities areas. And this should not be true at Purdue University, which is a great land-grant college dedicated to applied science and to teaching people the values of engineering.
Well, by our charter, which was written in the Land Grant Act in the mid-1860s, we were charged with the responsibility of not only offering instruction in engineering and agriculture and the mechanic arts, but in all other areas which could make a contribution to society. This was a pretty broad charge and an extremely important one. And it should be perfectly evident today that in bringing new knowledge to use, in meeting the needs of society, we must think of society as a whole and man as a whole. President Hufte's determination and interest in strengthening and developing new areas in the humanities and within the social science area also, following his appointment as president in 1946, I think set the pattern for the development of a new Purdue University. I doubt if we would be as well known and as well thought of as we are if we didn't have this balance.
Well, in this oral history project, I've heard quite a lot of talk about this, and it is true, Purdue's humanities has gone up to a very late start. And what we are talking about is essentially, now that you mentioned Mr. Hubney's program, what we're talking about is the fact that in 25 years, Purdue has changed 180 degrees, and it is just not the Purdue that it was in 1940.
There is no similarity. We are a whole new university and a much better university. And I must say that I believe the people in the basic sciences have been very, very strong supporters, not only of work in the social sciences, but more importantly, of the humanities and the arts.
I find this to be true with physics and chemistry, but not at all true with engineers. I have a tape, a interview on record in which one of the most powerful men in this university, I shall not name him, says that there should be no course in history, no course in English except business letter writing, and if you want to study these unessential subjects, you should go to Indiana.
When
this man has given millions of dollars to this university.
When funds become scarce, I must say that people tend to express some of the basic human feelings. We are more liberal when money and space is not difficult to come by. And as with the reduction in federal funds, with the reduction in support by the state legislature, people are becoming very critical of their neighbors. And they think of themselves first and their neighbors next. I'm not really surprised at this, but I think over the long period of time, it will become clearly proven that we must integrate all of our knowledge and use the best that we have in, whether it's agriculture, engineering, art, literature, history, or political science, to best serve society.
In other words, to paraphrase John Donne, no discipline is an island.
That is right.
I noticed something that reading the graduate bulletin, I noticed that you've noted it here. You say we have no fixed credit hour requirement and we have modified the foreign language requirement. Now, is this notable among graduate schools? Or are you directing this towards the fact that Purdue allows a great deal of autonomy to its schools and departments?
Well, Purdue University does permit a great deal of autonomy in the individual schools and departments. Now, most of us in the administration have been members of the faculty for an extended period of time. And I think that it is proper that we should think as members of the faculty. And we sincerely believe that faculty members in the various disciplines, in the various schools and departments, should be allowed to make the major academic decisions. Therefore, in the graduate school, for example, or as vice president for research, I must look as the first line to the deans, to the department heads, and they in turn to the individual faculty members of the university. And we want excellence in all of these areas. And with excellence, we must have responsibility. Now, Johns Hopkins University, which gets credit as being the oldest graduate school in the United States, almost from the very beginning, had very few fixed rules regarding the PhD degree. However, most universities define the PhD at least partly in terms of credit hours. And for many years at Purdue, in fact, prior to 1963, we had a sacred number of credit hours required for the doctoral degree.
Whether it was in animal science or physics or chemistry.
Right. And roughly, we expected at least 24 credit hours of coursework to be in the student's major area and 12 hours each in two minor or related areas. A faculty committee studied this matter for more than 2 years. We then took the faculty committee report to the entire faculty, and there were public and open forums held for discussion, and we were almost unanimous in our belief that we should allow individual major professors and advisory committees to program PhD students in terms of their actual needs. That if there was a student so well prepared that he could demonstrate by some kind of quantitative examination procedures that he needed no more coursework, then he should take no more coursework. If there were other students who needed a freshman or a sophomore level course in order to move ahead in a related area related to their research, we took the position they should have the freshman or sophomore course. To make a long story short, we now have PhD plans of study, which may vary from 20 hours to even 60 or 70 credit hours.
Depending upon the discipline.
It depends upon the discipline, the previous training of the student, the interest of the student, and the convictions of the major professor and the advisory committee as to the needs of that student.
All right. Now let's get down to the nitty-gritty of it. What about the money? You've seen quite a change, because I know when you came in, and, oh, 7, 8 years ago, there was quite a lot of federal funds going around, and now, of course, under an austere budget, I think that's what they call it, we don't have so much federal funds. But would you talk about something about the funding of research?
We might break this down into several different areas. As dean of the graduate school, I am extremely concerned about fellowship support. There is almost no disagreement among graduate deans that new graduate students, and probably graduate students during the first 2 years of graduate study, should devote themselves chiefly to acquiring the knowledge necessary for their research projects. This means whatever courses they need should be taken during the first 2 years. That if no duties could be assigned them during this period, this would be the ideal situation. Now, since World War II, the National Science Foundation, the passage of the National Defense Education Act, training programs in the National Institutes of Health and other branches of the Department of Health, Education and Welfare have greatly increased numbers of fellowships. During the past 3 years, federal fellowship support has been reduced by nearly one half. There are probably several reasons for this. One, the Congress is clearly disappointed and, in a sense, disillusioned with performances within the university. They regard the demonstrations, the student problems, as an indication that there is something wrong either with the system or with the management, and they have cut back on fellowship and training support. In addition, federal expenditures for a variety of domestic programs at home, for a great variety of foreign aid programs, and for involvement in the war in Southeast Asia have resulted in severe financial problems for the federal government. Various congressional committees and federal agencies, in looking for places to cut, have cut fellowship programs very, very sharply. Now, the growth of graduate work in all universities would not have been possible without available federal funds for research and for applied areas, such as many of the health areas. Now, none of these programs were intended to support graduate study as such. Graduate study was a byproduct. Every professor who has received a National Science Foundation grant for work in basic research usually employs one or two graduate research assistants to help in the project. In the health agencies, there have been many training programs specifically intended to increase trained manpower in areas such as cancer, heart disease. I personally feel that these programs have been very successful, not only in getting new information about the diseases, but in developing a highly skilled manpower which continues to work in these important fields. However, because of the climate in which we have found ourselves, at every opportunity, there have been cutbacks in fellowship programs, in research funds, in training programs. And frankly, this has a very serious long-range effect upon the universities and upon our future supplies of trained manpower.
There's something else, though, that has a sort of a silver, if I were golden, may I say, lining to it. I noticed it in 1960. We had 4 million plus research and related support. And in 1969, that had increased to nearly $22 million. This is indeed sort of a golden lining to the otherwise dark picture that you've been painting.
Now, the increase from 4 million to 22 million is a very substantial increase.
Was this government in the sense of state and federal?
Most of that is federal support. There is some from private industry and from foundations, but the bulk of it is federal. Now, one of the advantages in being in a growing institution such as Purdue, rather than a mature or stable institution, is that our faculty has consistently shown its ability to compete in a period when funds are getting much harder to get. And if we consider only the last 2 years, the fiscal year of 1968-69, our faculty presented various funding agencies 624 proposals, 402 were funded, and we received 18 1/10 million dollars in support. In 1969 and 70, which must be described as the most austere budget year we have ever faced, our faculty proposed 640 different proposals. Only 376 were funded, but they were funded for larger amounts because of the excellence of the proposals. And whereas the year before we received $18.1 million, during the past fiscal year we received 19 8/10 million dollars.
Well, that shows that somebody is doing some work and also, incidentally, how to write proposals.
I believe that our faculty have done as well as any university which I know, and far better than most.
Well, I'm delighted to hear that. Now let's get onto another aspect of funding of research. What about PRF, Purdue Research Foundation? These figures do not include the figures you've just given. Do not include Purdue Research Foundation.
The figures for the support which we just mentioned are from other sources. The Purdue Research Foundation was founded in the early 1930s to assist the university in carrying out its total educational mission. This again is a broad charge, and we do help in a great variety of ways. The foundation has total assets of about $26 million. Many of these funds are held in trust for very specific purposes. Some of the funds we have almost complete freedom as to their use. Now, for example, the XR Trust, which was set up largely as a result of contributions from Mr. David Ross, provides fellowship support in the amount of more than $500,000 a year for graduate student faculty combinations. We have an XL Trust, which was set up largely as the result of contributions from Mr. Charles Lynn, which is used for faculty support programs. We have a summer faculty support program in which we provide the summer salary for 2 months for younger members of the faculty to provide them an opportunity to engage in different types of scholarly work. During the past year, we provided approximately $70,000 from that fund.
This is where your young assistant professor needs a little help to polish off his first book or to complete the publication of his thesis, so he can be on record of having published a good book.
It is particularly important to the younger members of the faculty, the assistant professors. These men find themselves at a period of life when they often have heavy family expenses, when it's extremely difficult for them to take time off, and this program does provide substantial summer support to enable them to engage in scholarly work.
In other words, the PhD and the first baby arrive simultaneously. You need a little money.
They seem to be timed that way.
Yeah. Then were you responsible for establishing the Purdue University Studies? Did you have a hand in it?
The Purdue Found, I personally did not have a part in this. This had been established in 1960, prior to my involvement as dean of the graduate school and as vice president for the foundation. It's a very outstanding program for, again, assisting faculty members in publishing. Thus far, 25 books have been published and are being sold, and more are in process. The foundation has contributed about $65,000 in actual cash, but there is income from the sale of books, and the actual subsidization turns out to be relatively small.
We've done very well with it, though. Modest, but very well, I think. I noticed also you have faculty-oriented or faculty-originated publications in Philosophy, Man, and the World.
We help subsidize this journal. One of our professors, Calvin Schrag, is an editor of the journal. It is an international journal, and we are pleased to make a contribution to make it possible.
May I also say that as advisor to the Franklin J. Matchett Foundation, that the Franklin J. Matchett Foundation has given Purdue University recently $1,800 for Man in the World's publication, plus $1,900, and I hope an annual grant and a prize for work in the field of philosophy.
Although I do not regard myself as a competent critic, those who are in a position to know regard Man and World in a very favorable way. We're glad to be a part of it.
I can say this, that while I am not a PhD in the field of philosophy, because of my connection with the Matchett Foundation that must give all of its money to philosophy, this is one of the top half dozen journals in the world dealing with philosophy. And I notice you have design course, modern fiction studies, journal developmental reading, first stage and quartet. Now, these are all published as a result of efforts of the Purdue faculty.
Yes, these are all faculty efforts. Some are no longer in existence, but we did make it possible for varying periods of time to publish Quartet, for example, which was a poetry journal in which a number of our faculty members published and actually directed the publication. First Stage dealt with the theater. The Journal of Developmental Reading became such a success that it was purchased and is now published as a self-supporting enterprise. Over a period of years, we have helped a number of individual authors with subsidization necessary to bring a book to publication.
One of the interesting things about the modern fiction studies is that when people go abroad to Japan or to Britain or to Germany, modern fiction studies is, in a sense, the Bible that they carry with them. And it comes from the Purdue campus, which I do think is quite a feather in our cap because we don't think about the English department at Purdue as being internationally known, and yet because of modern fiction studies.
Well, again, these are all indications that the humanities area has not been neglected and is not being neglected and will probably in the future not be neglected.
Well, this is delightful. Well, let's get back to you. After all, you, as dean and as a scientist and as a scholar, have to become interested in honorary and professional organizations. For the record, will you just tell us some of those that you've been interested in?
Well, I am a member of a few. I was elected to Phi Kappa Phi, an honorary undergraduate scholastic organization. Gamma Sigma Delta, Sigma Psi, which is the most prestigious organization for scientists, and am a member of Gamma Alpha, which is a graduate scientific fraternity. I have belonged from time to time to a great variety of professional organizations. Among these, the American Association of Anatomists, the American Society of Zoologists, the New York Academy of Sciences. I am a fellow in the American Association for the Advancement of Science. I belong to several animal production groups, the American Society of Animal Production, the American Dairy Science Association, Poultry Science Association, and so forth and so forth.
As dean of the graduate school, are you on any national committees?
Well, my interest, once I got into administration, did change somewhat, and I have been active in a number of professional organizations that do involve graduate work and research. The Council of Graduate Schools, which I suppose includes 98% of all graduate schools in the United States. The Association of Graduate Schools, which is a branch of the American Association of Universities and involves the top 80 or 90 graduate schools in the United States. I am currently serving on the Council on Federal Relations, which is a committee of the American Association of Universities. We are concerned, of course, with not only the future direction of research in the United States, we are concerned with its day-to-day support by the federal agencies. Among the land-grant universities, the National Association of State Universities and Land-Grant Colleges has been a very important organization. I have been involved in and am involved on some of its subcommittees.
Have you had any other outside activities of this general nature of counseling, consulting, research?
During my years as an active research worker, I did a limited amount of consulting in industry, primarily industry involved with drugs and chemicals. I believe, as do we in the university administration, that faculty members should be provided with opportunities to do outside work in areas in which they have special competence. It's stimulating and rewarding in many ways, and it does provide a person an opportunity to be in contact with what some call the real world or the daily world. I do still a limited amount of consulting. I have had an involvement with the Rockefeller Foundation, which began first in 1957 when I accepted a position on a special mission to Latin America. I was served for a number of years as a member of the Board of Consultants of the Rockefeller Foundation and still maintain a relationship both with Rockefeller and Ford through friends on problems related to agriculture and higher agricultural education throughout the world. I have had a lifelong interest in the general problems of world food production and did serve on President Johnson's Commission on World Food Problems. At the present time, I am serving on a commission of the Organization of American States, which has been asked to make recommendations regarding the future support throughout Latin America of graduate programs and research in the agricultural sciences.
For example, the continuation or further services of the work that Purdue has been doing in Brazil with Brazilian authorities.
Our work at Purdue, our work within Purdue, with the University of Viçosa, Minas Gerais in Brazil, is generally regarded by outsiders as one of the two most outstanding university contributions in all of Latin America. North Carolina State College has received a very favorable comment for their work in Peru, but I think that Purdue's work in Brazil has had even more influence. Now, since World War II, there have been literally dozens or even hundreds of separate projects of various magnitudes within AID or other foreign assistance. And when one or two stand out as the Purdue one, then I think this is a real accomplishment.
Well, there's no question of it. Just again, personal, what academic honors have you received that you'd like to mention?
Well, I think the one which gave me the greatest amount of satisfaction was receiving an honorary doctor of science degree from my own alma mater, the University of Massachusetts. And it again is satisfying to me that on the same day, Dudley White, the most distinguished cardiologist in the United States, Henry Cabot Lodge, and Thurgood Marshall, the outstanding Negro jurist and a member of the Supreme Court, received honorary degrees at the University of Massachusetts in the same convocation.
You might remember from Thurgood Marshall that he was the man who, in Columbia, Missouri, in the Boone County Courthouse, defended Lucille Bluford at the time that the University of Missouri School of Journalism said that the little Negro college down in Jefferson City was as good a journalism school as Missouri, and sought to deny her admission.
Thurgood Marshall has been a real leader, a very outstanding individual. I have received some other awards. I received the Morrison Award for Research in the Animal Sciences. This award was established by the late Professor Frank Morrison, was a distinguished nutritionist at Cornell University. I did receive the Sigma Psi Research Award here on this campus for outstanding research, and the University of Missouri did give me the Distinguished Alumnus Award several years ago. I believe these are the ones which have given me the greatest satisfaction.
Well, you've got to do something for fun to relax. What do you do to relax?
Well, I've had a variety of hobbies over the years. My hobbies have changed from time to time, and I think I could go back, if I had time, I would go back and be active in some of them. I think probably my first hobby was photography, and after developing some sort of sub-professional competence in this area, I became too busy to do the things that I was doing. I had a hobby of cabinet making and making furniture reproductions, which I followed for a number of years. I would very much like to have the time to get into the shop in my basement to do some of these things again, and hope eventually to get back into both cabinet making and photography. As a young man, I had always hoped that I'd have an opportunity to do some sailing. We couldn't afford a sailboat when we were young, and I now have a small sailboat in my backyard and sail when I can. I'm still learning.
Do you take it up to Freeman?
Yes, we take it up to Lake Freeman where the wind blows.
Yeah.
I hope eventually, I would like a larger boat to do some serious saltwater sailing, but that will have to wait some other time.
Well, we've gone through this list pretty well. Now, there's always, as I end it, I always ask everybody, there may be some questions that we have omitted here, and for the record, I'll say that if we need another interview, we'll have one. But tell me, no question, has it been worth it? But let's talk about the future. What is going to be the future of Purdue University and its relationship to education? You want to speculate?
There are several trends developing in higher education in the United States and within the state of Indiana, for that matter. Some of these, I feel, are wrong and will try to pursue other courses. For example, I have little enthusiasm for the development of an entirely new group of small community colleges. I will admit that large universities do have certain deficiencies. We do need to change from time to time, but I am firmly convinced that the efforts that we people in Purdue University and Indiana University have carried on for a long period of time have been with the objective of giving the people of Indiana the most education, the best education, and the best value in education.
In other words, are you talking about the campus, the off-campus, and the regional campus?
No. I regard the regional campus
as part of
our system.
Very good. All right. I just wanted to make it clear.
And I think the regional campuses are a necessary, an exciting, and a realistic system for bringing high-quality education throughout the state. The thing I am concerned about is the development of a whole new series of small, autonomous community colleges and junior colleges.
For example, a Lafayette Junior College.
I just don't see the need for a Lafayette Junior College. Now, there is a great deal of support for this movement throughout the United States as a whole. Some people still want their children to go to school close to home. Well, our regional campuses make this possible. I think it is correct that there's no student in the state of Indiana that's more than 35 or 40 miles from either the main campus or regional campus of one of the four state-supported universities. In addition, we have some very fine, privately supported colleges and universities within the state of Indiana, and I would like to see these fully supported, rather than to create a new type of university. I believe that any university must continually evolve, and that if one carried on the same traditions in the same way for a period of 10 or 20 or 30 or 50 or 100 years, I would be the first to say there must be something wrong with that university. I believe that Purdue University has evolved into a university which has been better and better almost year by year, and that given the financial support within our own General Assembly, by the people of this state, And with adequate support from the federal government, I believe we will continue to serve the people of the state of Indiana and the nation in a better way than we have even in the past.
You feel strongly about future of your own work? For example, I am interested in what is involved, quite frankly, in graduate work with interdisciplinary research and a program that must involve the professional knowledge of men outside the field of history and political science. I'm interested in such a program. Is this going to be a general trend, you think?
I think we all recognize that that as more knowledge becomes available, it becomes more necessary to integrate all of that knowledge for some common cause. For example, I cannot conceive of people being trained for positions of policy in our United States State Department today without knowing something about science as well as about history and government and politics.
I remember, and to, if I may use an example of our own ag school, of men who were trained in discipline of agriculture, going down to Latin America and suddenly running into historic social customs and language barriers and saying, why in the deuce didn't we know about these before?
Some of these situations are so simple as to almost be ridiculous. For example, in one of my studies in Chile, which involved, among other things, technology which would improve the milk supply of Chile. People with technical knowledge in animal breeding, in animal nutrition, and animal management made all types of recommendations which would improve the milk supply. Why didn't milk supply increase? Because the government of Chile had a price ceiling on milk, and the price at which milk must be sold was so ridiculously low that nobody would produce milk. So that one must understand economics. Secondly, it is true that in much of Latin America, and in fact, in most of the developing nations, the nutritional problem deals principally with quality of protein. In many parts of the world, there are adequate amounts of calories, but the calories are not balanced, and people suffer from deficiencies of one sort or another, but particularly protein. Some academic people said the solution is easy. We will enrich the food supply by developing small cookies or cakes or biscuits or whatever you want to call them, which have a balanced protein enriched with fish meal. These were produced. They completely met the nutritional requirements of test animals such as rats and do meet the nutritional requirements of humans, but humans won't eat them. One's food habits are not changed overnight.
Nor are religious habits changed overnight, and dietary habits, so on.
And who is to say about a person's religion in relationship to his dietary habits? We're not going to change this. We must learn how to meet the nutritional requirements in another way.
That's right. Well, have you anything else? Have we omitted anything that we should have put in?
From my own standpoint, I'm pleased with the interview.
Very well, then. We will say that this terminates the interview on July the 30th, 1970, in the offices of the Dean of the Graduate School of Purdue University, interview between Frederick N. Andrews and R.B. Eccles. This is to be used by the Purdue University Archives.